Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Follow me on Twitter, @RyanBallingy. You can find my work at thegolfnewsnet.com or at Yahoo Sports, a presenting sponsor of the program, at sports.yahoo.com. You can also find Golf News Net on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com and twitter.com/golfnewsnet. If you're a subscriber to the show through iTunes, thanks so much for your loyalty to the show and enjoying it that way. Please tune in to Golf News Net Radio, which is a 24/7 stream of golf talk available on our website, golfnewsnet.com, our on-demand site, golfnewsradio.com, as well as through the TuneIn Radio app. This week on the show, we continue our string of interviews, and this one is with Paul McGinley, the 2014 winning Ryder Cup captain. Mr. McGinley was a part of Golf Channel's coverage for the last couple of weeks over here in the States, taking a little break from his usual time with the team at Sky Sports on the European coverage of the PGA Tour, which he does a brilliant job with. And he's been over here this week not only for that coverage, as well the Masters, but also to do a clinic at a residential community in Florida called Windsor. And so we talked with him briefly about that, as well as his feedback on Jordan Spieth, the new Masters champion, Rory McIlroy, who he said would have a wonderful Masters, especially playing alongside Tiger Woods, and what he tries to impart on people when he's talking about the sport of the game, not only on television, but also through a live demonstration. I hope you enjoy the interview. Well, first of all, tell me about Windsor and how you got involved with them and how you got involved with doing this clinic today.
Well, I met Mr. Weston about 10, 12 years ago for the first time in Sunningdale. We played golf together in Sunningdale, where he's also a member. And he told me you must come out to Windsor over the next number of years. Kind of met him again, and he said, when are you coming to Windsor? So it was kind of that. And we eventually came last year. We had our first time last year. We were here for 2 weeks last year, had a great time, and a return again today, this week. Sorry, a return again for the last 10 days.
What do you like about the facility and specifically about the golf course?
I like the fact that it's got a community spirit to it. People are incredibly friendly, and all ages as well too. Lots of children around too, which is great for us with three young kids. And it fits all the boxes. Obviously, that you got the golf there, but you've also got great tennis facilities and beach facilities and horse riding. It ticks a number of boxes, and at the same time, it doesn't feel like a resort. It feels like a community, which is really nice feel to it.
Who are some of your favorite golf course architects, and what do you look for when you look at a golf course and find one that really suits your eye?
Well, golf course architecture is something I have very strong views on. I think a lot of modern golf course architecture in particular is too difficult. The landing areas are too small, the greens have got too much slope on them, and a lot of water hazards which come into play and make things difficult. So I like the old style ones, obviously, people like McKenzie, Tillinghast, those old kind of style. Harry Colt in Sunningdale is a big favorite as well. He's done a number of courses in Ireland as well as the UK. So I like the old style golf courses where it's playable for all levels.
Does modern architecture, in your opinion, go too far in trying to create that wow factor with courses because so few open these days?
Yeah, I think, aesthetics is important, and framing holes is very important. But I like that, and I like all that. That's important, very important. But it must be combined with a test that's not too difficult. I'm all for having it beautiful, but it's got to be a test as well at the same time.
shifting gears a little bit from architecture to TV work, you've done some work from Golf Channel for the last couple of weeks and really enjoyed watching you on TV. What is the experience like of doing the American version of golf broadcasting versus the work you've done with Sky in the past, and what kind of aspects do you like of each style of broadcasting golf?
Yeah, TV is very, obviously American TV is very different. It's a lot more fast-paced. It's, you know, the pitchers change a lot quicker, and your points have to be made in a very fast manner compared to Europe, which is more of a kind of a lazy manner of presentation, lazy in terms of time. It's a kind of a slow-moving manner. Lazy is not a good word. Slow-moving, more of a slow-moving presentation, whereas over here it's very fast and snappy and moving from one subject to another. But I've really enjoyed it. The 2 weeks I did with the Golf Channel were a huge learning curve for me. Great experience for me in terms of broadcasting. I'm very impressed with the Golf Channel and the professionalism and the team they had behind them and how they went about it. And I thoroughly enjoyed my 2 weeks there. Is broadcasting something that I'm going to do, hopefully lead into and do the rest of my career? Not necessarily. I'm doing it because I enjoy it. And we'll just see where it goes. I've got a number of irons in the fire. One of them is the bit that I'm doing around the majors and world events in particular with Sky Sports in Europe.
What's been your approach toward broadcasting? Because you have the likes of a Brandel Chamblee or a Johnny Miller who almost try to be brash, and that rubs some people the wrong way. And I think that probably your approach is a little bit more palatable to most people. Is that what's the line you have to draw between trying to be informative but not overly critical?
Yeah, that's a fine line, I know obviously all the players very well. I like to describe things better in terms of the difficulty and also read the situation, which is important as well too, and how the player may feel in a certain situation and how he deals with it. So context is very important, and description is very important as well too. Kind of colouring in, particularly when I do the commentary, colouring in what you're seeing on TV, not just saying, here's Tiger Woods, middle of the fairway with a 5-iron, trying to describe a little bit what kind of shot he is required. And as he addresses the ball, you can see what he's going to be drawing it or fading it or what he's going to do, and kind of, putting it into context of how he's playing in that particular day. So just kind of layering it with some context and layering it with some description.
I don't think if you've never been there, you probably can't fully explain to somebody, but how close can someone like yourself get to the viewer in terms of what the player is experiencing? How close do you think they can really understand it to really what's happening inside the ropes?
Well, I'd like to think that I can read what's happening and read what a player is going through and, read what's in his mind. And, at the end of the day, course management is course management. And managing your game is managing your game. And everybody's game is different. They play the game and see the game in a different way. So when you're describing one particular player, it's important to be in that player's mindset of who he is and what he does and what his tendencies are. If the pin is on the right-hand side and he's a natural drawer of the ball, to use a simple example, it's obviously this is a difficult pin for him because his natural shot is a draw here. The pin is on the right. The wind is coming off the right. So he doesn't have many things going in his favor. A good shot for him is 20 feet pin high left. And that's the kind of way you would kind of say that about a particular player who would be a right-to-left dominant player.
You said something leading into the Masters where you thought that having Tiger in the field would help out Rory McIlroy, and obviously you didn't know that those two guys were going to play together on Sunday, but it turned out that you were right because Rory played some great golf, especially for the final 45 holes of the tournament. What do you think really spurred on McIlroy after that so-so start for the first round and a half?
I think he just got in his rhythm. I think the way Jordan started the tournament took everybody by surprise. Mm. Normally a Masters or normally a major championship kind of ease your way in. But the way Jordan played the first two rounds, 36 holes, and remember, he was finished his 36 holes before Rory had started his second round. Mm-hmm. And he had posted a number of 14 under par before Rory even started. So, you know, it immediately put everybody on the back foot, Rory included, who were playing in that afternoon session on the Saturday. You know, if Jordan won the Masters anywhere, he won in the first 2 days. You know, we said in our commentary on Sky that, you know, he'd basically broken the back of the tournament, and if he'd have shot 270s over the weekend, or 271s even, it was very likely that he was going to win. And that's exactly what he did. He played steady from then in, but he certainly broke the back of the tournament the way he came out of the block so fast. And I think he caught everybody by surprise. And as a result, guys made mistakes. And I think, you know, Rory was one of them that made the mistakes on the morning of the second day when he was trying to chase down a 13-shot deficit.
How difficult is it for a player to see a huge lead, especially when you get that late early wave and you get to post a number and you're, before you even tee off, you're looking at a huge deficit? How difficult is it to not try to step on the gas too hard and just continue to play your game and hope to chip away at the lead instead of trying to take that temptation to try and almost get it all back as quickly as you can?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult. Incredibly difficult. Jordan took advantage of that with the way he played, particularly in the second morning. It's one thing shooting 64 and having a great day the first day, kind of like Jordan did, but the follow-up with a 66 the following day basically put a huge amount of pressure on the chasing pack, and he created a lot of distance from the chasing pack, and as a result he was able to, you know, just hold steady over the weekend and not have to, like, kind of was able to play within himself and keep the pressure on the other guys. And, you know, as we saw, although they played very well over the weekend, they still were making the occasional mistake. I mean, it's like a guy going around a racetrack in a NASCAR. You know, the more he presses, because he knows the guy is so far out in front, the more he's going to spin off every now and again. And that's what happened, because Jordan, in the first 2 days, had spread-eagled the field and took control of the tournament.
What were your impressions of Justin Rose's performance on Sunday? He came out of the gate and tried very hard to put some pressure on early, and then just, I think, maybe fell a little bit to the pressure of having to chase a guy who was 5-6 ahead and who kept up with him. So what did you think of what Justin did?
Justin did really well. I mean, bearing in mind, Justin didn't have a lot of form early season going into the Masters. He'll walk away with very pleased in how he played, how he performed. He certainly put it up to him. I think if he'd have got within one or two shots of Jordan in the last round, it would have been very interesting. But Jordan, being the great competitor that he is, was able to keep everybody at bay. And once, you know, once Justin was making birdies, I think it was a great reaction from Jordan. Jordan was then able to make birdies himself. I mean, you know, Justin hit it in close on one and made birdie, and Jordan, you know, did the same and followed him in for birdie and kind of kept that distance at four shots. And I really feel that Jordan was able to play within himself and play with a little bit less pressure than you would expect, because he had such a healthy lead over most of the field, and he knew that as great as they did have to play, he also had some shots in the bank as well too, and he could afford the odd mistake and still lead the tournament. And as a result, I think it took a little bit of pressure off him.
What were your impressions of Jordan heading into the Ryder Cup and through the Ryder Cup, and how did you as captain for the European side account for him or think of him in terms of managing your guys?
I didn't think about him too much. I knew he was a good player. I'd watched his results. But what I did learn at the Ryder Cup about him was how great a competitor he is, and that's why I was pretty sure when he went into the lead after the two rounds that he wasn't going to fold and that this was a guy going to be around for the weekend and very likely to win a green jacket. When he posted a second round score, I knew he wasn't going to back off the situation. So I learned he was very much very not only a great player, but he was also a tremendous competitor. And as great a player as he is, and as great a putter as he is, his biggest asset that he brings to the table is his competitiveness, in my view. And having said that, when it came to the Ryder Cup, it was inconsequential to us. Our opponent, I believe, wasn't the American team at the Ryder Cup. Our opponent was ourselves, getting our attitude right, getting our pairings right, and that's what we focused on. We didn't focus at any stage on the Americans or what they were doing, because you can't control what your competitors do. It's just a given. America's going to be very strong. They're going to be very motivated. They're going to play well. There's going to be some attrition out there. Two heavyweight boxers going against each other, and just take it as a given. America's going to be strong, and Jordan was going to be part of that.
Is that an attitude to carry forward for any player playing competitively, whether it be on a major stage or in your club championship that you've got to focus on yourself, and really you're playing against yourself regardless of how many opponents you have?
Yeah, I mean, there's a mixture, obviously. You know, you do have to react a little bit to what the other guys are doing. Look, everybody's different. Everybody sees it in a different way. When it came to the Ryder Cup, as I say, our opponent was in America. Our opponent was, I knew we had a very good team. I knew we had, I put a lot of effort into the pairings, and I knew we were going to be well prepared. It was important to get the attitude right and get the players up for it, and the players buying into my ideas. And that was done over a two-year period. That just wasn't done on the Monday, Tuesday practice rounds of the Ryder Cup. That had been done, and that was a two-year process evolving towards that. What I said in the media and what I said individually to the players was very much based around how difficult a task we had and making sure that our attitude was right, explaining to them the partnerships that I had in mind, and showing the statistics and the data as to why I was putting each player with a partner and what was the reasoning for it.
One last question for you, and we'll come back to what you're doing today. When you're giving a clinic, what do you find the amateurs and the everyday player wants to know most from you, and what do you think is the most important thing that you can impart upon them if they're paying attention?
The most important thing for me is simplicity. Trying to give them something simple that they can walk away from. I mean, I can sit there, I can stand in that range for I can stand in that range for an hour and a half and talk theory and talk swing planes and talk grip and posture and fundamentals and all that kind of stuff. I can do all that, but I'm probably going to bore them, and I've heard it all before. So I've got a snapshot of an hour or 40 minutes of their time, and it's important to impart something simplistic that they're going to come away from and thinking, I'm going to try that. That makes a lot of sense.
And what's the question that you hear most from people in clinics, and is it the right question that they should be asking you?
That's a good point. Most people, they want to see me hitting shots. They want to see, show me how you draw it, show me how you fade it. And I don't think they should be asking that, because it doesn't apply to them in their games. You know, a lot of them should be saying, how do I get it airborne, or what do I do? So I spend a lot of time talking about the harmonization between the arm swing and the body swing, and how important that is. That if you get them out of sync, you're going to face trouble. So that's kind of what I speak about most when I do that. And it's also chipping as well, too. Give them some areas and simplistic ways of chipping the ball.
Well, Paul, thanks so much for taking the time. I appreciate it. I know you got a busy schedule today, so I thank you for the 15 minutes.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. All the best. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye-bye. Thank you again to Paul McGinley for being a part of the show. We really enjoyed the conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as well. Email your feedback to me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. You can also find me on Twitter @RyanBallenge. You can give us an iTunes review, which we would really appreciate as well, or find us on Facebook and twitter.com/golfnewsnet. Until next week on the show, when we may have a guest and we may not, I'm Ryan Ballenge saying thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.